I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, along with Mel, K2KEY, 2-0 Cobra 6 net. And you guys have heard it thousands of times, well, more than 1,000 times before. Main purpose of the TechNet is to gather the clan and help each other with information about how to enjoy this hobby a little bit more. How do these transmitters and receivers really work? What's the best antenna transmission line? How does propagation work? 26 different kinds of ham radio. We discuss as many of those as we can. And subjects that are of interest to ham radio operators are the main subjects discussed on the technical net. It doesn't have to be exactly ham radio. Ham radio enthusiasts are curious people. They like wireless, they like electronics, and so any subject along those lines. We sometimes get into high-definition television and video cassette recorders, computers, things that are related to electronics and wireless electronics in particular. A person who has a question or a comment for the net signs in with his call letters, his name, and he follows that with a yes, which means he does have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this. WSQN, Paul, and yes. Paul is our man who supplies information about what NASA is doing. So we have any check-ins tonight. Please give me a call letter and name at this time.
KABQ-DXZ, name is Bill, and that's a yes.
QOES, right, and yes.
Okay, KV2DXC, I think it was. Did I have the call letters correct, Phil? Delta X-ray Charlie, is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct, sir. Delta X-ray Charlie.
Okay, and Fred, was that Whiskey 2 Oboe Echo Sierra? Fred, was that Oboe Echo Sierra? Do I have the prefix correct, Fred, Whiskey 2?
That's correct.
Okay, do we have any other check-ins at this time? So far, we've got Phil and Fred. Anyone else to check in?
Into GOT, Howard.
No. Okay. Howard with a no. Anyone else? So far we've got Phil, Fred, and Howard. Anyone else?
Good evening, all.
RYY.
Joe. Question? Yes. Okay, RYY, Joe, and Mel, of course. WE2RYY, Joe. And one last call. Anyone else besides Rich, Mel, Phil, Fred, Howard, and Joe?
WB2TGY,
no. No, Tony.
Okay, Tony with a no. Let's start it with Phil. KB2 Delta X-ray Charlie. You're number one on the runway tonight, Phil. And looks like we don't have a whole lot of people, so you can take your time with your questions.
Okay, thank you, Dick. KB2DXC here. It's been a while since I checked in. Thank goodness you guys are still around. My question relates to cliff dwellers like me, those who live in apartment buildings, my case, second floor of a five-story building. And when I read articles about antenna construction, be it on QST or on the web, it's always reference made to, say, antenna heights above ground, either in feet or wavelength. You know, they might say an antenna must be mounted X number of wavelengths. An apartment dweller who has an antenna on the roof of a building, what do those terms supposed to mean? What am I looking for with that? You know, with earth ground, electrical ground, RIW, K82, DFC.
Yeah. Very fine, Phil. Done. Good question. And it's a question that's not well explained in any of the books that I have seen. I'm going to give you my impression of what I think is going on. Another person who's done a lot of experimenting with altitude is a guy from the Kings County Radio Club, and we just happen to have one of the smartest guys of that club, Mel, so I'm going to turn it over to him after I give my opinion. Picture yourself as a radio wave, and you've just been emitted from an antenna. And although your eyes looking at that ground see grass, concrete, macadam, fire hydrants, we see all of that stuff because your eye has high resolution. But let me just pick a number. Let's assume that I'm on 20 meters. And I'm 20 meters where the wavelength is 60 feet long. If your eyes operated at 20 meters instead of where they really do operate at 550 nanometers at the middle of the visual band. At 20 meters, if your eyes operated there, because your wavelength is so big, 60 feet, you couldn't tell the difference between a bus and an automobile. They would just be a bright white object. Until you get something as big as a house, then you could tell the difference between a house and a school. But a bus and an automobile, you couldn't tell the difference. It's obvious that a wavelength that big doesn't see fine details. To a wavelength that big, there's a real antenna above the ground. Let's assume that your antenna is on the second floor of your building, the second floor, I'm going to pick a number, is 40 feet in the air. So the antenna is 40 feet in the air. That ground, as far as your wavelength is concerned, is almost a perfect mirror. You see that ground as something very rough and bumpy, and it's got automobiles and fire hydrants and buildings and whatever. To a wavelength that big, that ground is almost a mirror. That means that there is a real antenna above the ground by 40 feet, the one you've erected. There's a mirror image of one below the ground. And the way ground reflection works, a signal that's horizontally polarized, reflecting off the ground, undergoes a phase reversal. So now, what you and I are trying to do is we're trying to send as much signal out to the horizon. The closer you can get that signal to the horizon, where it can just miss the ground, go out into the air, and hit the ionosphere at a very gradual grazing angle. You get the best reflection, the longest DX, when you hit that angle as low as you possibly can get. And now what's fighting you is you've got a real antenna above the ground, and you've got a second antenna 180 degrees out of phase below the ground. So if I go out there a mile and figure out what's going on, I've got the in-phase signal coming at me, I've got the out-of-phase signal coming at me from ground reflection, and they almost cancel on the horizon. As I start to moving my point of observation a mile away, higher up in the air, I'm doing a field strength measurement on a helicopter, and I'm now raising the helicopter above the ground. As I do, the path of that signal down to the ground and up to me is becoming longer. The path of the signal from the antenna to me is not becoming longer as fast. That's the way it's really happening with the bounce. But I can get the exact same answer if I assume that I'm only measuring the distance between the real antenna and me, or the mirror image of an antenna below the ground in me. I get the exact same answer. So as I raise my helicopter, you can see the path to the mirror image antenna below the ground is getting longer. The path to the antenna above ground is not getting long as fast. So at some angle above the ground, those two signals come back in phase. A half wavelength at 20 meters is 10 meters, 30 feet. If I can make the path to the lower antenna 30 feet longer than the upper antenna, the out-of-phase reflection becomes back in phase. And that might occur at a number like 30 degrees above the ground. So there is some elevation above the ground where your first main lobe of vertical pattern comes back in phase, you get a strong signal. You study the geometry of this jazz, and you'll tell you that as the antenna is more and more wavelengths above the ground, that first lobe where the signals come back in phase gets closer and closer to being on the horizon. And the closer you can get to the horizon, the better the DX you're going to get. Now, having a signal that's low to the ground, and therefore the main lobe is now higher up in the air, it's not a showstopper. It's a NEVIS antenna, near vertical incident skyways. As long as you're on a low enough band, like 80 or 40 meters, where a signal hitting the ionosphere at a very high angle still gives you a reflection, you can have some short-range QSOs. You can talk to your buddy in Pennsylvania instead of your friend in London, so to speak. So for each antenna at each wavelength, there's an ideal altitude that's going to give you the angle of reflection that you're looking for. Most of the time, the higher the better. So, does that signal really see the building that you're on? Pretty much not. Yeah, if there's a copper sheet on that whole roof and the antenna is above it, of course that copper sheet is going to dominate. But very few buildings are built that way. If your eyes operated again at 20 meters and you looked at your building, you're going to see some vertical pipes, you're going to see some wiring, you're going to see some plumbing, but this stuff is almost transparent. Most of the wood of the building, most of the plaster, the sheetrock walls, The wooden floors, pretty much transparent. Only the ground is the real sheet of reflecting object that counts the most. What I'm giving you is 90% true, not 100% true. Of course, you're getting a little disturbance from the building. The wood has got some dielectric constant to it. The signal flows through the wood pretty transparent, but gets slowed down a little bit. So things get distorted a little, but I'm giving you the main impression of what I think is going on. So try to mount your antenna as high as possible. Don't worry about things like buildings and trees when it comes to HF frequencies. They're primarily transparent. And know that you're going to get a higher angle of radiation if you don't have enough wavelengths above the ground. Not a showstopper, but just don't expect to be the strongest signal on the long DX path when you're trying to break a pileup with that rare station in the South Pacific, so to speak, or that guy in Australia, or that guy in New Zealand. You run enough power, you do enough good operating. Usually, if you can hear them, you can work them, as long as you've got good operating practices and enough steam and the right kind of modulation and the right ways of attracting him to you. So don't let this discourage you and stop you because you can't get the signal the right number of wavelengths above the ground. Just know the limitations you've got where you live, and the possibility exists you can get permission eventually someday to mount the antenna at a higher floor on the building, run a cable up there, you make a deal with a super, you put up one of these stealthy antennas where it doesn't show, but it's still radiating from a higher angle. Hams are crafty people. There's a lot of different ways of doing it. So these are some of my opinions. You may have a couple of questions on the stuff that I said. I'm going to turn it back to you briefly, Phil. And then after you add your comments and or questions, whichever you like, we're then going to turn it over to Mel, because I'd like to hear his plans on this, because he's worked with antennas that are nowhere near as high as he would like, and yet he's done some darn good work. He and his very group of guys at the King County Radio Club. So back to you, Phil, for if you need some Phil. KB2DXC, K2RIW in the tech mat.
Okay, K2RIW, KB2DXC. Let me clarify what my setup is here. I live on the second floor of a five-story building. Over the past few years, I swapped between HF antennas and UHF, VHF antennas on the copper flashing around the very low parapet wall. From what I understand, what you just said to me is that my antenna, from to my antenna, actual earth ground is what the antenna is seeing itself. So okay, I can say that my antenna is, you know, five stories up plus whatever number of feet is on the antenna map. Is that correct?
On HF frequencies, the answer is a hard yes on that, Phil. When you start getting up to VHF frequencies, where now the amount of copper on the roof is becoming large in wavelengths of that particular antenna, on a VHF or UHF antenna, and your antenna is above a roof that is 50 foot square, and you're operating at a 2 foot wavelength on 450 megacycles, now you've got a very different environment, where now the more local ground might be that chunk of copper. So you have to view the metallic object that is or is not the ground in wavelengths compared to the frequency you're operating at. So when it comes to your 20-meter antenna, only objects that are large compared to 60 feet are a local ground or a reflector. When it comes to 450 megacycles, whether it's a 2 foot wavelength, things that are large compared to 2 feet can now be a local ground. And there's some sliding influence in between those two, but I think you see the principle. Let me turn it back to you, Phil, see if that made some sense. And by the way, I think you have the ability then to go to the fifth floor of the building and at least do VHF operating, or maybe if you make a sufficiently transparent antenna, a 20-meter dipole up there out of skinny enough wire, maybe you'll get permission to do that. You will definitely get better operation on the fifth floor than the second floor. It doesn't mean you're going to be stopped on the second floor. You're just not going to have as much DX and as loud a signal on the horizon, and it's going to be a slight disadvantage, if you know what I mean. Now back to you, Phil. KB2DXC, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KB2DXC. Yes, what you just explained now makes everything a lot more understandable. My past experience, I have had some HF antennas on the roof, I've had some UHF mother buildings. I have more antennas than the Russian embassy ever had, and I did quite well with some, you know, looking at maybe rotational dipoles and the like. But that is my history, my experience with doing HF. It's never been negative. Talk about, you know, once again, wavelength, feet above, you know, the rooftop, or the X number of feet above the roof in terms of technical things. Told me just now about, you know, vocal ground in relative, in relation to RIW.
Yeah, you get a little bit of a feeling for this. If you hold your finger in front of your face, but your eyes are faced, are focused on the far wall of the room, your finger doesn't give you blockage. Well, there's funny things going on there because you've got two separate eyes in operation, but your eyes are, your finger is small compared to the spacing between the eyes, which is a little bit like wavelength in this case. So that's a, that sheet of copper on the roof on 20 meters is 90 some odd transparent. That sheet of copper on the roof is a flat copper roof on the building, and it goes on for 60 feet square, and your UHF antenna is in the middle of it. As far as the UHF antenna is concerned, that's the local ground. So ground is a very relative thing, as you can tell. It's wavelength sensitive. It's impedance sensitive. When it comes to good grounding for lightning protection, the word ground has got a very different meaning than when it comes to the ground reflection you and I are talking about, which primarily dictates your vertical angle of radiation where the peak of the beam is. And when it comes to horizontal antennas, you're always going to have right on the horizon a null, and it's very hard to get around that. That pushes a lot of people into vertical polarization. But vertical polarization, by the way, vertical polarization reflecting off the ground doesn't have that phase reversal. You can't get a signal down at the horizon. That's the good news. But most guys, when they put up a vertical antenna, are putting up a quarter wave vertical ground plane, which only works well if it has a large amount of counterpoise, a large amount of a ground plane radial, acting like a sheet of copper under the antenna. And in many cases, that's so hard to do that if you've made a pure vertical dipole hanging off the side of the building, as crazy as it sounds, that could be an extremely high performance antenna. Because the best counterpoise in the world is another quarter wavelength of wire acting like the other half of the dipole. That's what's really going on with a vertical antenna. The vertical radiator you look at is the upper half of the dipole. You're trying to create the other half of the dipole by making a mirror image and a great big sheet of copper. And that's what all your ground plane radios are trying to do. And it's very hard to do in some circumstances. And if you're smart enough to realize that a pure vertical dipole is a real vertical antenna with a perfect counterpoise, the other half of the dipole is really there, you can get some very big performance out of that. For reasons I don't understand, most of the antenna handbooks that you and I can lay our hands on don't say that. And so the few guys who have a tree that's high enough in the backyard, and with a bow and arrow or with a slingshot, they shoot a piece of a monofilament line up there. The line pulls up a cord, the cord pulls up a rope, the rope pulls up a pure vertical dipole on an HF frequency. But the few guys who have had the nerve to do that,
repeater, timeout,
a pure vertical dipole, and whether you feed it at the center or feed it at one end, if you're smart enough, it doesn't matter once you make the impedance correct. But a pure vertical half-wavelength dipole fed wherever is convenient for you with your smart can have a tremendous amount of performance right down at the horizon. Its phase center is higher up above the ground. That helps. Pure vertical polarization gives you a lot of signal as far as the vertical pattern is concerned. The elevation pattern on the horizon can give you an awful lot of performance, and it's not covered in any of the books. Let me pass this over to Mel, who's lived with this problem. He's got the world's highest performance vertical dipole hung with green wire in the green tree, a conifer, or in other words, an evergreen tree in his front yard of his house in Brooklyn. Nobody sees the antenna, and he's getting a lot of performance out of it. So give us some of the words on this one now, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Good evening, all. Yes, as Dick said, I have experienced quite
good working condition, especially with a 40 meter and a 30 meter. Well, I guess we can call it sort of a vertical or sloping type of dipole somewhere in between. It sort of drops down sort of straight and then curves over on the bottom. I just optimized basically by experimenting up and down with it to see how I could get the best peak signal, especially into stations in Europe. And as Dick was saying about grounding and height and all, ideally, if we had the best of all worlds, like to live on a cliff overlooking the ocean. And why do I say that? If you had a house on a cliff overlooking the ocean, you would have dropped off over salt water. You will be able to achieve what is known as a takeoff angle of about 10 degrees. Found with a takeoff angle over salt water, you can realize usually about a 7 dB more gain than its counterpart on land. Now, when we talk about, I guess, ground, Earth ground, Earth itself is a conductor, but it's far from being what we call a great, you know, a perfect conductor. And so, let me let it drop. So that's an antenna, let's say a vertical antenna, show you how it varies, that no one fits all, literally. A vertical antenna, let's say, HF, being used out west, say where Texas, Nebraska, or whatever, those beautiful flat lands, you know, low hills and all that great rich soil, great ground of this type is considered good conductivity. The vertical could work really well. Now you take the same vertical antenna and you say, I'm moving. And where do you move to? Someplace where it's real rocky up north, like New Hampshire, that part of Connecticut, Massachusetts. And now the performance of that HF vertical is not so great. So, what do we have? We have a situation where you got to try. Nothing that Dick says is going to blow up or, you know, or whatever. You can try. Let me let it drop one more time. The rule of thumb, if you look in the books, you know, ARRL, a lot of computations, you want to boil it down, they show that for frequencies, as Dick was saying, around 14 megahertz, 20 meters, and antenna height somewhere between 40 and 70 feet seems that they're working quite well. So, in other words, you do the best you can. But this is basically the story on antennas. That, you know, we can't all have the best of the world with the, you know, powers that reach up into the ionosphere and all, and have that, what they notice, that low takeoff angle over the ocean, whatever. So you do the best you can, and that's it. And like you said, even Dick said, even the basically become the NVIS type of antenna, it still gets out. And again, you'd be amazed what I could do, what I've done. So let me let it drop one more time. In fact, today we had an outing here at the park. Our club, the King County Radio Club here in Brooklyn, had an outing today at the park. We set up a little station, and with a vertical, a homemade vertical, a few radios thrown out on the ground, and we worked several stations into Europe on CW, band, even with the band conditions being pretty miserable, low propagation, and all, yet I was able to easily get a number of contacts into Europe. So that's the best I can really say about it. Of course, everything is part of nature, especially the solar, sunspot cycle, all these are variables. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you very much for that information. Now, let me add something else to this one, Phil. Most of the materials you and I would use for HF antennas, not counting a beam, but when it comes to rhombic dipoles and inverted Vs and loops and things like this, most of the materials are not very expensive. As such, don't put all your eggs in one basket. You may have a horizontal dipole on the fifth floor or the second floor right now. Try a vertical also with two separate feed lines and flip back and forth between the two. One of the things Mel has discovered, there are times when his horizontal antenna
is gangbusters into Europe and the vertical's not making it, and vice versa. And it changes from day to day, because polarization is a peculiar thing that we all forget about, and that is Faraday rotation. When you mix together a plasma and a magnetic field, you have a Faraday rotation medium. In other words, the plasma I'm talking about is called ionosphere. That horizontal signal you launch from Brooklyn will tell you that's where you happen to live. When it gets to England, might be vertically polarized. You would therefore think that if the guy in England is listening with a vertical antenna and he sends back a vertical signal to you, he would assume it comes horizontal. Well, Faraday rotation doesn't obey reciprocity. Horizontal signal that you launch becomes vertical in England. England launches a vertical signal, and it might end up vertical in your backyard. So if you have both a horizontal and vertical, and you experiment at both transmitting and receiving, you'll see some exciting results that differ from day to day, various states of the ionosphere, and so on. So as long as you can keep your antennas low enough in profile and not physically abusive to the neighborhood, let me drop. Even though you think you've got a darn good antenna on 20 meters, if that happens to be one of your bands, and it's horizontal, instead of building a vertical also and hanging it down the side of the building with weights, or consider a loop antenna and a rhombic and so on. So don't give up on just one antenna that maybe is giving you okay performance. By the way, as you do these experiments, as you're probably going to do, and by the way, none of us as amateurs anymore build our transmitters or build our receivers on HF frequencies. On UHF, some of us still do. And on 10 gigs, 24 gigs, yeah, you have no choice but to build. But on HF, we buy the thing, and for a very good reason. You get a lot of bang for the dollar. But when it comes to the antenna, that's where a lot of tinkering and experimenting can take place. And so, and the materials are not expensive, and if you do something wrong, it doesn't explode, it doesn't catch on fire, it just doesn't perform well. You come back to the tech net, you said, I tried a such and such, and it acted like this, and I'm not happy with it, what do you recommend I do now? Come on back and tell us about it. So you've got a good subject. When it comes to getting high-performance antennas in an urban environment, there's a lot of guys in your particular boat, and they're all looking for the ideal answer. And it's different from guy to guy. KBC TXC, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW, KBC TXC. Okay. You've explained a lot.
Settling on just one particular antenna in particular, although I think I'm going to go with a dipole.
Well, it's kind of about, just radiation patterns or something, because I'm going to get my, off the sides of the antennas. How much of an effect do, being above an apartment building as opposed to above the ground level will affect that?
Okay, when you talk about radiation pattern, I think you're talking about the building disturbing the pattern, or you're talking about radio frequency biohazard radiation. I'll cover both. I'm not sure which you were talking about, but on HF frequencies, let's talk about a 20-meter dipole, which is going to be, 32 feet long, the whole dipole. Yes. You're taking your 100 watts of power, if that's what you're transmitting, and you're basically smearing it along those 32 feet of wire. And so the watt per foot on the wire is a relatively small number. Yeah, if you ran a kilowatt and if the antenna goes right through the middle of your apartment and your head is 1 foot away from it, that ain't good. But any reasonable distance, 5-10 feet, from the wire of a 20-meter dipole with 100 watts on it, rather safe. When in doubt, you can make measurements, you can do calculations, but the most unsafe thing you could do would be to put a kilowatt into a dipole on 432, where the dipole is a little bit more than 1 foot long. You're putting the whole 1,000 watts onto that 1 foot object. You put your head 1 foot away from that object with 1,000 watts on it, and 100 watts is getting into your body, and that ain't good. That's pushing it. So it's not only a function of how many feet and how many watts, it's a function of how big is the antenna. And correspondingly, a moonbounce antenna on 432, which consists of 16 Yagis, which is smearing that power over an antenna that's 20 feet wide and 20 feet high. The 16 Yagis are
a great big bed spring with those dimensions, you're smearing your power over 400 square feet, and you stand directly in front of an antenna with your radiation hazard meter, you'd be amazed how safe it is. I've done that experiment while they were radiating a kilowatt during a moon bounce experiment at a temporary site in Minnesota, Rochester, Minnesota, the meeting of the Central State VHF Society. I stood in front of 16 Yagis radiating 1,500 watts key down, and I held a radiation hazard meter in my hand, and it was safe. Opposite of common sense. The higher the gain the antenna, the bigger the antenna is, the more it's smearing the power over a large area. Therefore, the watts per square foot or the watts per human body become smaller and smaller when you stand in front of it. So some of this is not obvious until you get into the details. For now, when it comes to the pattern, how much is
repeated, timeout, cancel,
GGY. The other question you were asking is how much is the building changing the pattern of your antenna? And the answer is relatively little. As I said, the chunks of metal that can be acting as blockages, as shadows, or as reflecting objects, until they get to either being a resonant length or until they get substantial compared to a 60-foot long wavelength of 20 meters, they're primarily transparent. If, for instance, your horizontal dipole, 40 feet in the air, is directly parallel to the Con Ed wire across the street, which is parallel to it, and it's in the direction of England you want to talk to, common sense would lead you to believe, hey, my piece of wire is smaller in diameter than their Con Ed power wire. It's directly horizontal, exact same altitude, in front of me, across the street. You would think you're going to get a blockage in that direction. Absolutely not. As long as that wire of the Con Ed is not resonant. If it was an 80-meter dipole, because I know the numbers there, an 80-meter dipole, if you could see it with your eyes radio-wise, it'd be a great big oval in space that is 140 feet wide, 60-some-odd feet high, 8,500 square feet is the radio area of a resonant half-wave dipole on 80 meters. It is sucking up energy from that much space. The energy ends up going down your feed line and moving the signal strength meter. That piece of non-resonant guy wire or non-resonant Con Ed wire across the street is casting 1 square foot of shadow onto your 8,000 square foot antenna. The magic of resonance is all that area comes out real big, real fast, and it's a square law phenomenon. So if I go to 20 meters, which is 4 times higher in frequency, 1/16th of the area, 1/16th of 8,500 square feet is a lot of square feet. And the Con Ed wire is casting a shadow of a couple of square feet on it if it's not resonant. If the Con Ed wire just happens to be a resonant length, very unlikely, then all of a sudden it's got the same area as your antenna, and you're going to get something like 3 dB of loss. So from this point of view, you can see that normal objects that your eye sees as massive, the radio wave, most of the time,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The radio wave will see it most of the time as a transparent object. So you have to think in the wavelength of the radio frequency you're using, and almost neglect what your eye sees, which is an extremely high resolution device. Your eye has a resolution of 1/60th of a degree of beamwidth. You can place two objects, like the two horizontal lines on your television screen. You put your head the right distance from the television screen, so those two lines are 1/60th of a degree apart, 1 minute of arc, and your eye, a good, clean, young, well-working 20-year-old eye, will resolve those things. 1/60th of a degree of beamwidth is what your eye has. Your 20-meter antenna has a beamwidth of around 100 degrees. That's what, 6,000 times greater, if I get the mathematics right. So you can see the angles of resolution, the wavelength, the blockages. It's amazing how much difference there is when you look at it from the right point of view. I don't expect all of this to make sense the first time you hear it, Phil. Come back a few more times, we'll repeat some more of the story, we'll tell it to you from a slightly different angle, and all of a sudden it'll start making a little more sense. KB2DXC for any other fills. Phil for a Phil. KQLAW in the second half.
I'm going to tell you one more thing, Dick.
Okay, Phil first and then Mel after that. Phil, go ahead.
Okay, well, Phil doesn't have any more Phils. I thank you very much for
see a little bit later in the evening.
KQRAW, KB2DXC.
Yeah, I'm going to cover those two subjects. You've got two guys after you, Fred and Joe. And after with those, we'll go back and cover what resonant really means. Be amazed what it is. Mel, you wanted to add some words? Go right ahead.
And to RVP.
Hold on, everybody. We'll get to you. This is K2KUI. Now, I was just going to say in closing that the pattern, antenna pattern, or what was known as the elevation pattern, which for a 40-meter dipole, you mentioned, how I did a few experiments and did some plotting, and I found that if you can achieve the ultimate or the ideal height with your 40-meter dipole, somewhere around around a half wavelength on 40 meters, somewhere around 65, 66 feet, you'll find that if you do a plot and use the ground conductivity, average ground conductivity for this part of the country, and the dielectric constant of ground, and you'll see that if you can get up approximately around 65 feet up, that with the plot, I can see it was around over 7 points, over 7 dB over isotropic. Whereas if you went down further with the antenna, say down to a quarter wavelength, you could see how that drops off drastically and also how the pattern now becomes the no major load. It seems like it's more of a circular pattern, and the dipole really drops to very low or really a no gain antenna other than minimum over isotropic, which would be very little. But that's about the best I can tell you. You know, you got to really experiment and see the effect. But this is what I was able to observe and plot on Mini-Neck, Dick, over.
Yeah, Mini-Neck is a nice way to plot these things and get some ideas of what happens when you change local ground conductivity, altitude, configuration of the antenna. If it's a Yagi antenna, what happens if you tilt it up in the air, which usually does very little, but there are lots of guys who think so. The other Phil from Englewood, the N2RVP, Phil, I guess, is number two. You're either checking in or you've got a question or a comment on the subject that's on the floor right now. If it's a question on the subject, we're going to take you immediately. If you're checking in, then there's two guys ahead of you. N2RVP, K2RIW, my name is Dick. Okay, I did hear N2RVP checking in. The next person who signed in was a man from Keensburg, Fred, KC2OES. Go right ahead, Fred, with your question or comment.
Very good. I'm going to contribute to the former question there with my own, and I'm probably going to add to it unknowingly. I have a CL33M Mosley. It's a tri-bander, 10 meter, 12 meter, or 12, let's see, 10, 12, and 15 meter beam. I don't have the feed point. I have no boom, but the boom isn't really part of the problem. The problem is trying to figure out how I can make the feed point without buying it from Mosley. Spoke to Mel on a few occasions about it, and I was wondering maybe if someone had parts, had a beam that they wanted to sell, and maybe you can help me try to figure out the formula, if there isn't anyone, to make the feed point for this particular bar IW KC2OES.
Is that to RVP? I checked in also. Okay, and to RVP, I called you just a few seconds ago, and I guess you're saying it is a check-in, which I guess implies that you do have a question or a comment. And we'll get to you right after the two guys ahead of you. One of them is Fred that we're going through right now. Fred, from what you've said, when you said the feed point is missing, well, on most Yagis, I presume your Mosley beam is CL33M. I presume it is a Yagi-like structure with a dipole-like thing that feeds it. Am I In the right ballpark so far, Fred, before I proceed, go ahead.
Three elements, they're trapped elements, ten.
Okay, now the driven element, you got traps on the reflector and director. Is the driven element there with its traps, but just the method of connecting the feed line is not there? What is missing? You said the feed element is missing, but that has a lot of different words, a lot of different ambiguity there. So give us a few more words, Fred, as to what is missing. Go ahead.
Okay. The part that is missing is the coax or connection, the matching system. In other words, the elements, the actual tubing is there, the insulators and spacing, so on and so forth. About how to make the actual matching system for this particular antenna. I can clarify a little bit of this, Dick.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, I've discussed this with Fred a number of times on 10 meters. The beam he's talking about, Mosley, what they have on the driven element, they have the driven element insulated off the moon by a length of aluminum bar. It's about, I don't know, about 3 or 4 feet long, and it has standoffs on it, and the driven element sits on that. In the center of this element, of the driven element, there's a split, and in there goes a type of a piece of insulating material that Mosley had made up that the element can slip in on each side and lock in. And also, there's an end connector at that point. Now, what they do, they slip from this end connector, from the center of the end connector, they take a piece that looks just like plain the center of the RG8U coax, without the shield, without the outer covering, the PVC or polyvinyl chlorine, or whatever they call that, covering. They get rid of the shield, they just use the center with the insulation, stick that into one side of the element, take another piece of it like that, and from the other part of the connector, the ground, say the outer shell of the connector, and push that into the element in the other way. And that is the method of matching that Mosley had. And he'd like to know how long are those two pieces of coax that you just shove into the elements on each side. How do you determine how long they are, over?
I see where you're going here. If it was a simple dipole in space and there were no parasitic elements around, no reflector and no director to pull the trap, the question you're answering, asking, could be modeled on the right kind of a computer program by way of the graph that you can find in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. You know, something about the impedance that the driven element dipole is going to present. You know, something about the impedance matching that piece of concentric coax cable shoving down the element is going to produce. However, once you add a reflector that's nearby, a director that's nearby, trap elements that even make those much more complicated, the chances of modeling that are very slim. I was about to ask you, have you ever seen a picture of the right thing? Have you ever seen a diagram of it? Can you get a hold of a picture or a diagram? That certainly would help. And part of what you're doing here is asking tonight, is there anybody within the listening audience who owns or has data on a Mosley CL33M beam, a 10, 12, and 15 meter three-element Yagi? That would help. If somebody's really got hard data because he has one, he's willing to take it apart, make measurements for you, or he's got diagrams that show what it's like. I'm a little bit skeptical that the diagram exists because Mosley probably considers that proprietary information. And it tells you, here's the way you assemble it, but they don't give you dimensions and exact engineering data. I think you're going to have to find it experimentally. But let me get some good news and some bad news. I've given you the bad news. Let me drop and give you some of the good news. And by the way, I will pass it open to the net in case there are other people out there with helpful information for Fred on the Mosley CL33M. We certainly want to hear from you if you know anything about the antenna. But here's the good news, Fred. In the case of a Yagi, a lot of people don't really know what a Yagi is. I can give you some fancy words. It's a synthesized flow wave structure. The end-fired antenna, the gagging thing, synthesized flow wave structure with a particular velocity profile that focuses energy in a particular direction by a refractive optics phenomenon. Fancy words. What does it really do? Assuming now that the director is working correctly, the reflector is working correctly, and you don't have damaged traps, so they're electronically doing what they're supposed to do. In that case, all that's required to properly light up that Yagi is for the driven element assembly to radiate in a dipole-like manner and give you a good impedance match to your particular transmission line. That's all that's required. If you've got a reasonably low standing wave ratio, I'll take a number less than 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. When you feed the driven element by whatever means you feed it, and because it physically is approximately a half-wave dipole with its traps that Moseley designed, and they're properly installed, and they haven't been damaged, then all that's required is for you to feed energy into that driven element dipole assembly. After that, the Yagi will take off. And so all you've got to do is experimentally try a long, a short, a medium, different length of coax cable that you insert until you find the right length that gives you a reasonable standing wave ratio on at least one of those bands you care about. Once you get the standing wave ratio of the driven element within numbers that you like, and because you haven't physically changed the position or the layout of that driven element dipole, and you haven't changed the director and reflector, after that the rest of the antenna will work. So you only have an impedance matching problem. I didn't say it's easy, but now at least we've scoped the problem. If you can do whatever you can, and whether or not you keep the Moseley feeding technique, or you go to some other technique, a hairpin feed, a gamma match, a T-mat, a folded dipole feed or whatever, anything that you experimentally try for feeding energy into the driven element is strictly up to you. As long as you can feed energy into that driven element dipole and get a reasonable impedance match and a little bit of balancing action, you don't want a whole lot of current flowing down the outside of your coax cable, and you can get rid of that by making a poor man's choke. A couple of turns of the coax cable in the vicinity held together with black tape will do that for you. So once you feed energy into that driven element, the rest of the, and with low visual, the rest of the antenna will fly. Let me see if I am, I'm on the right track with getting the concept of what I'm trying to say here, Fred. I'm going to turn to you, Fred, first. KC2 OES, K2 RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I understand everything you're saying. Now, they give you dimensions for the coils, for the turns, the element length for foam or CW. I'm setting it up for foam. I believe it's shorter length on all the elements. The driven element is the thing I'm obviously working on, but let me ask you this. Your knowledge has sparked a question that I have for you. If you're telling me that there's, well, I could figure out how to make a dipole for 10 meters, but because it's three different bands, or coils involved in it, what would be the logical thing? Would it be shorter or longer, the matching system?
Yeah, I wish I could say shorter or longer. The answer is none of the above. One band at a time, you can experiment with the Moseley feeding technique and experiment with length of coax where you take the, if I understand correctly, you're taking the semiconductor and the polyethylene shield without the braid on the outside, and shoving it down the right hand inside of the dipole and the left hand side of the dipole. And you got to choose the right length in order to get the right impedance match. First of all, I wonder, why can't I think of your name? Do you already own a Moseley TA-33, the guy who just signed it?
W2EWK, Jack?
Yes, Eugene, do you own a Moseley TL-33F?
No, I have a phone number where you can call and get the information right from Moseley.
Okay, let me first ask Fred. Do you think that would do you some good, Fred, if you talk to Moseley directly, assuming they're still in business? Fred, over to you.
Yeah, and they won't give it any information, Dick.
Okay. It looks to me like, Eugene, you've made an attractive offer, but Mel has already been there, and Mosley is holding this information close to their chest. They consider it proprietary. They consider it their design, and they don't want to release it to the public. So if Fred talks to Mosley, most likely he's not going to get what he wants. Looks to me like you're going to be experimenting. And because there are traps involved on both the driven element and the parasitic element, which disturb the limit daylight out of the impedances on the different bands in funny ways, when you're matching a tri-band Yagi like this, you want a certain impedance match to the driven element on each of the three frequencies. You want a certain electrical phase length of the reflector and the director on each of those frequencies in order to get the Yagi focusing effect to give you more power out front than out the back. A fair amount of complicated things are going on. My recommendation here is that you start off one band at a time, experiment with their method of feeding it, but you don't know the right length, but you can find it. And by the time you chew up a few pieces of coax, experimenting with length, and you plot the antenna standing wave ratio across the band. Say, for instance, the 10-meter band you care about, and you plot it at 29.5 megacycles. And when you make a plot of that, the plot will be a bathtub-shaped curve. There's a low point somewhere, and the low point is what you and I would call the resonant point. And if the low point falls high in frequency, you know that something is too short, and if it falls low in frequency, something is too long. So it's like a blind man walking up a hill. If the tilt of his feet can tell him which way is up the hill. When you look at that plot of Vizwar versus frequency, you know that you're too high or too low, which means that you're too short or too long, and it'll tell you which direction to go in order to improve it. And by the time you choose the right length of coax that gives you a match on whatever is your first band that you try, maybe it's 10 meters if that's your favorite, there is a good possibility that you'll be close to the right match on the other two, because that's the way Mosley did it. And so a magic length that works on 10 meters is probably going to work on 10, 12, and 20. Those are the frequencies, 10, 12, and 15. So it's going to, as long as Mosley...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
As long as Mosley's not going to tell you, and you're not going to find some magic amateur who's got the right information, you're down to a cut and try, but it's a finite number of experiments. I think in one day of experimenting, I think you're going to hit it. Now, let me turn it back to you, Fred, for comments on this. Drag your feet a little bit in case there's somebody on frequency that wants to volunteer information on a Mosley CL33M for you. KC2OES with a little delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Mel had a suggestion, and Mel can correct me if I'm wrong, if I didn't get this straight the first time. Basically, if I took the driven LX to try and get resonance or low SWR on 10 meters, and I'm looking for a center frequency of 28,400, if I can get that to be close, would that be, based on what you said, you're telling me that it'll probably work on the other two frequencies, correct? But only assembled with just in other words, I'm going to experiment with the driven element all by itself, not with the full assembly.
Negatory. The driven element, the impedance of the driven element goes to hell and gone when you put it in the vicinity of that director, reflector, assembly with all those trap coils. I wish the answer is you can match the driven element all by itself. The answer is absolutely not, Fred. You're going to have to put the antenna all the way back together, mount it at some slightly reasonable altitude. I mean, you do this test with the antenna laying on the ground, obviously you're going to get a pretty yucky answer. So you're going to have to mount the antenna at some kind of an altitude where it's starting to work, and the antenna's got to be completely assembled when you're doing the speed flashing. And there's something else in your favor. That is, if you can get at least the beginning of an impedance match on any one of the three frequencies, and if you're using an antenna tuner, which has enough tuning range to it, the fact that the antenna might have a 5-to-1 Vizwar on some other band. Your antenna tuner will take over on the other band. The fact that the antenna has a high vis wire on those other bands doesn't matter. With your antenna tuner, as long as you can couple power into that driven element, regardless of its vis wire, and as long as that driven element is physically in the right place so that it radiates in a dipole-like manner and lights up that Yagi, the whole thing will fly. So you've got a lot more leeway here than you know about if you had an antenna tuner. Without the antenna tuner, you're going to have to do a more careful tuning job. But as long as you've got an antenna tuner with enough range and you can couple antenna power into that driven element, the thing will fly. I'm back to you, Fred, and see if that made some sense. KC2OES, K2RIW.
Can I comment on this deck, KC2KY?
Okay, yeah. Mel first and then Fred. You pass it over to Mel. Fred, you got a Mel.
Okay, now, this is, so you said you can't work on the driven element by itself. Mosley used to sell that driven element for 10, 15, and 20 meters, that element, three elements. They sell you the single element and use it as a rotary dipole. Then they said that you can, in the future, they'll sell you a reflector, making it into a two-element beam. They sell you the reflector with a boom. If you want to go to the next step, which this is not being offered anymore, but I'm saying this was the original concept. I knew Mr. Carl Mosley many years ago, nice gentleman, and he always encouraged amateur radio to do experiments. He'd sell you materials, parts, give you any kind of help, as long as he got feedback as to what you see or were able to achieve. And that's the way he used to sell it. So now you go ahead, and he never said anything that you had to make any readjustments on a matching or anything. You sell your dipole element, you can make a, then buy from him additional, make a two element out of it, or a three, or whatever you like. You can start out and just put the thing together, in other words, as your pocketbook or your experience changes it over.
Okay, that's good news, but there's a problem. Mosley made that pronouncement, I'm guessing, way back in the days when we didn't have solid-state broadband finals. We had things like a DX100 and a KWM2 and whatever, where you had a real Pi network, and that Pi network had a lot of tuning range to it. I am rather positive that with rare exception, you add a reflector and or director to a driven element, and the impedance match changes significantly. A 1.2 vis wire could become 3-to-1. But back in the days when you had a Pi network, real tuning and loading control on the transmitter, that was nothing, that's no problem. You could tune it back out and everything would fly. With a modern day solid state rig, you don't have anywhere near that amount of leeway if you don't have an antenna tuner that you've added to it. That's my belief. Mel, let me just pass it back to you and see if you agree or disagree with that. That's perfectly all right. Go right ahead, Mel.
Well, the only way I can disagree with this is if the experience, because I know a number of people that went through that type of situation where they bought the original dipole element and it was working quite well, and then they added, they made beams out of it, they bought, you know, additional elements. It was very nice because, you know, really put together a beam by step. And with the additional elements, whether they bought just a reflector or bought the reflector with the director kit or whatever you happen to do, I do not remember anybody commenting that the matching drastically changed or their SWR...